Well, welcome. Good afternoon. I'm Rick Barton, the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project with Karen von Hippel, who's here in the front row. And we're very pleased to have you all here today. And welcome to CSIS on behalf of our president, John Hamry. It's always a delight to have a good mix of people here, and that's once again what we're doing. My job is very simple today, which is to introduce Shannon Hayden, who's one of our colleagues in the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project. She's going to introduce the program, but I just want to add our personal welcome to two old friends, Patrick and Nadia. You've been associated with our program or with us as friends for many, many years. Patrick, in particular, really helped us get started on all of our early Iraq War. He was here before the work. He was here before the war and was really an invaluable advisor to us and really helped to ground our thinking in terms of what we thought might happen in Iraq. And I think the tone of realism that we brought to our early work was really the result of an awful lot of his good advice and the work that he had done on Saddam Hussein and the recovery from in particular, the post-Kuwait war period in Iraq. So welcome. It's nice to have the two of you here, and I'll turn this over to Shannon.
For the past 2 years, the PCR Project has been looking at how the U.S. government engages with religion abroad. And in our report, Mixed Blessings, which was released last year, we concluded, among other things, that there's a big knowledge gap. There are, in many of the places, like Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, the religious dynamics are not understood, the key figures aren't known, and we just don't understand the culture. And so this is the first in a series of speaking events that we're going to be examining poorly understood religious leaders around the world. We're going to talk about Muqtada al-Sadr today and maybe a little bit about Ali Sistani. And in the future, we're going to be looking at people like Khomeini in Iran, the Islamic Courts Union in Somalia, and some of the different mullahs in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So today we have with us Patrick Coburn, who's the author of Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shia Revival and the Struggle for Iraq. You have his full bio in front of you, but he is the Iraq correspondent for The Independent. And joining us, too, is Nadia Bilbasi Charters, who is working with the Middle East Broadcasting Center and has covered a number of conflicts from the front lines and is now in a different kind of front line covering the White House and the State Department. This event's going to be podcast and put up online probably tomorrow, so tell your friends and stuff. And please check out our blog at pcrproject.com.
Great. I'm really glad to be able to conduct this kind of interview that normally we do it on air, but now we're doing it in front of a smaller audience. First of all, I want to recommend this book. It's a great book. It was an easy read, and I'm saying that not because me and Patrick are fellow citizens. We are both Irish. He doesn't know it, but actually I am. And I did work for The Independent as well, so we have so many things in common here. But honestly, this is really a good book, and I think everybody should read it. The name is Muqtada. You started by saying, although he did not introduce him till chapter 9, you talked about him as how the Western media labeled him with different names, the firebrand, the maverick, insinuating a troublemaker, basically. In Iraqi dialect, you will call him Zatut, which means like the ignorant child. Yet you presented him in a different image that we haven't seen before. Calculated, know when to confront and when to retreat. He seems to be smart, engaging, managed to mobilize a massive movement called the Sadriya, the Sadrism, rely on very important two names, Sadr al-Baqir, his father-in-law, and Sadr al-Sadiq, who was his father. Both were assassinated, tortured, and killed by Saddam Hussein. Why there was the misreading? How come everybody, the Americans, the Iraqis, and the media misread who is Muqtada al-Sadr?
There are a number of reasons why they didn't realize how important he is. I remember in 2003, you know, how astonished they were that suddenly this man they'd never heard of seemed to control much of East Baghdad. And Sadr City is actually a twin city to Baghdad. It's always described as a district, but it's really 2 million, 2.5 million people of population, and much of southern Baghdad. Why was it such a surprise? there'd always been an underestimation of how his father, Mohammed Sadiq al-Sadr, who was assassinated by Saddam's gunmen in 1999 with two of his sons, had built up this massive movement, which was, it was populist, it was nationalist, it was religious revivalism. And Muqtada really took that over. And also he came from a family of martyrs. His father-in-law, Mohammed Bakr al-Sadr, was this great Shia theologian who had been executed by Saddam in 1980. So Iraqis on the street, and it's always been a mass movement really of the poor Shia, but most Iraqis are Shia and most of them are poor. This was the person they empathized with. And they'd often compare him, maybe a little unfairly, with foreign exile. Iraqis had been foreign exiles who they imagined had been cavorting in five-star hotels in Los Angeles or London while they'd been suffering under Saddam. So this was an enormous political advantage for Muqtada.
I mean, in the end, though, you concluded, I'm going to go backwards here, but you were talking about the future of Iraq, basically, is held by Muqtada al-Sadr, and to a certain extent, the mistake that the American did, led by Paul Bremer, the first civilian governor, was to exclude him from power.
Sure. I mean, but one should also say that Muqtada's main political principle was to end the American occupation of Iraq, and he's always stood by that. So it's kind of difficult for Bremer to include him. But Bremer had this curious mixture of reactions to Muqtada, which is one to say he's a potential Hitler of Iraq, and secondly, to imagine he could send a few police around to arrest him. Now, one is true, or the other is true, but both can't be true. And, of course, you know, there was an enormous uprising, and Muqtada took Najaf, actually took over most of southern Iraq. So there's that continual underestimation. And it goes on, you know, the time now, the Iraqi army moves into parts of Basra controlled by Muqtada's militia, the Mehdi army, into Sadr City. They move into Mosul, that's a slightly different thing. And there's an assumption, well, all that's over, and somehow they're in control. But it's a very Iraqi situation. You see a lot of soldiers there. I was in Mosul the day the army moved in, and, you know, they declared a curfew on vehicles, and a curfew on people. There's nobody on the streets but army and police. You know, so in a way, you think they've got control, but actually they haven't really, because this is a Sunni Arab city. They don't really control it. They'll stay there a couple of months. They'll make a number of arrests. But the actual control is sort of formal. It's not very real. I remember in slightly earlier when in Baghdad, in Sadr City and in Basra, the Iraqi army was worsted and then called in the Americans. But I think the strategy of Muqtada since 2004 has been to avoid a direct military confrontation with U.S. forces or with his Shia rivals when supported by U.S. forces.
I mean, if we say a little bit on him as a character, do you still see him playing that central figure in the future of Iraq, or is it a little bit over-reading or exaggerating his position and Jaish al-Mahdi, which we'll talk about in a
minute? Well, you know, this is the biggest, it's only real mass movement, political movement in Iraq. but of course, it's confined to the Shia community, and it's basically confined to the poor, although that's millions and millions of people. I mean, anybody emerging as the leader of Iraq, it's very difficult, because in Iraq, you make a friend, you make an enemy, you know, and politics is fragmented. It's a mosaic, and the mosaic is continually changing. So, you know, is Muqtada going to go out of business? No. Is he very important? Yes. But, you know, there are other people who are important. You know, Masoud Barzani, leader of the Kurds, Ali al-Sistani, you know, the Grand Ayatollah. All these people have great influence, but it's very difficult to ever dominate the game in Iraq, even if you've got lots of military power like the United States. The reason is that society is fragmented, and if you try to be top dog, so to speak, all the other dogs will turn on you. And even Saddam couldn't. I remember just after the fall of Saddam, I was in a hospital near Sadr City talking to the neurosurgery, then a neurosurgeon in the hospital, and he just managed to avoid his hospital being looted. And he said to me, just remember, Saddam Hussein had real difficulty controlling Iraq. And then he laughed and said, you know, let's see what happens to the United States. This is a very difficult country to rule.
Of course. Well, the British tried it before. But the bottom line here for Muqtada is maybe unlike the other character you have mentioned, whether it's Barzani or Sistani, he has an army. And his army is very strong, and now the confrontation is between the state represented by Nour al-Maliki and what is being seen as a militia operating outside the law. Is it a similar scenario like, say, Hezbollah in Lebanon, for example, you're trying to disarm them and they will fight? Or how will it work in terms of political kind of sharing power?
Well, first of all, everybody already has a militia in Iraq, you know. The Badr organization, I think, 3 years ago, I remember, declared itself was a cultural organization. and although behind my stay in a hotel in the Jadriya district, you know, and actually, you know, 200 yards from the back gate of my hotel, there is a Badr headquarters with guys with machine guns, you know. So it doesn't, you know, and obviously they're enormous, they control largely the Interior Ministry and some of the Ministry of Defense. So the Peshmerga or the Kurds, exactly the same, you know, there's a the Kurdish, I sometimes go with Kurdish units to Mosul and so forth, they get their orders from Erbil, not from Baghdad, quite openly, you know. That's so everybody has a militia. So the idea it's the state via the militia is a bit naive. It's really, you know, a division within the Shia community. And with one part, the Supreme Council of Iraq, the Badr organization, one part of the Dawa group, wanting to eliminate Muqtada, particularly before the elections at the end of the year. And nobody quite still knows how strong the state machine is. You know, it ought to be strong. You know, you could produce one vision of Iraq that Maliki is going to be the Iraqi Putin, you know. But the Iraqis, they're kind of desperate for peace. Putin traded on that, controlled the state machine, ramshackle, corrupt, but it existed. And a whole lot of money because of the rise of the price of oil. But again, I'm very dubious about this because the militias just, they went back to their houses because Muqtada had told them to do so, both in Basra and in Baghdad. And secondly, when it actually came to real fighting, it was the U.S. Army doing it and not government units. In Basra at the beginning, you know, that Maliki and was hoping that, you know, that they'd win immediately. But the first demanded that the Mehdi army hand over their weapons. But the first shots that Iraqis saw on television was of the army handing over their weapons to the Mehdi army. Mm-hmm. So it was really the kind of, because only when the U.S. moved in with firepower, air power, advisors and so forth, that the balance of military forces changed. Now, it is, you know, you can't be certain, but how far will the state machine, the army, really be able to get a grip on these places? This is by no means certain. It's not a done deal. I mean, I find in the papers here people saying, reading an article by a Krauthammer in the
Washington
Post this morning, which had a list of sort of 10 things happening in Iraq, which I thought was actually incredibly useful because it's 10 things that are misunderstood about Iraq, you know. You know, if you base a policy on this, you lose, you know. Saying they've taken over, but that, you know, that is not clear. Iraq has always been full of this, as armies may take over, but who are they really loyal to? Who's the Iraqi army loyal to?
Right.
Nobody knows that. At the moment, the Maliki government's feeling, you know, a bit more confident, but they don't know the answer to this either.
But in the same token, you can talk about the loyalty or the disconnect, or maybe a militia within a militia within the Mahdi army. Another question is how much Muqtada Sadr controlled the Mahdi army.
Well, when he wanted to declare a ceasefire, he's been able to do it. You know, there were doubts about this. He's been able to, so he does have overall control. Secondly, obviously, it's an umbrella organization, which you had criminal gangs that were groups that were funded by the Iranians, were local sort of lead warlords, so to speak, who are part of the group, who kind of acted semi-independently. And I think they genuinely want to get a grip on this. And they're getting something of a grip, but it's not total control. It also should be said, one shouldn't be too sort of naive about this. At various moments, it's clearly been real convenient for them to say, when there's been some particularly nasty killings, say, oh, gosh, yeah, you know, we don't control that. No, they don't, but they don't because they don't really want to, because they want to disclaim responsibility.
And that was the case in terms of the implication of the killing of Sayyid Majid al-Khoui, who some will say maybe, but not exactly.
It's very easy to get killed in Iraq. I mean, I was almost killed a year later by a Mehdi army just near there in Kufa. And I'd come down from Baghdad to Najaf when it was under siege by the U.S. Marines. And I made a mistake. I thought that the dangerous bit was on the road, so there were some very dangerous Sunni towns on the road, so I'd put on a red and white kafir headdress. Not any close up anybody who'd think I was an Arab, but just somebody 50 yards away, window of the car, figure in the car, they just think that is an Iraqi. So I had no trouble there, but when we got to Kufa, suddenly there was this checkpoint. Guys very nervous, heavily armed. And they sort of looked through the window. There was fighting with U.S. Marines, so they're particularly in AG state. And they tore off from their headdress, and they started screaming, American spy, American spy. And I was with two Iraqis. They started dragging us away to shoot us. And the two Iraqis thought we were, that was it. But then one of them said, look, maybe we'll check with the sheikh first in the mosque. So they, obviously we survived. But then tens of thousands of Iraqis don't survive, you know. This is a whole land of checkpoints. I mean, earlier it was January, I went to Fallujah from central Baghdad, and I counted 27 checkpoints on the road. And it's not a long road, you know, it's 30, 40 miles or something like that.
And you were telling me just now, basically, the security situation hasn't really much improved. And being a journalist, it's very difficult to operate still.
You can do it, but I mean, you talk to Iraqi, have things got better? Sure, yeah, they have got better, but they've got better than the bloodbath we had in 2006, 2007. And President Bush and others here were saying there wasn't a civil war, but there was a very bloody civil war between Sunni and Shia. There was really a battle for Baghdad, which essentially the Shia won. Mm. Baghdad had a majority of Shia before, but now I'd say it's 75-80%.
So it's like ethnic cleansing in a way.
Sure, and it's still there. You know, I mean, the thing people say, you know, is it better? First of all, what do you compare it with? They compare it with the bloodbath. Secondly, how do we judge this? Now, I've always taken it. There are 2 million Iraqis in Jordan and Syria. Many of them in a very bad way. They can't earn money. They're sitting in some damp room in Damascus with their families. They can't get jobs. You know, women becoming prostitutes, trying to keep the family going. They would go home if they could. If security was good enough, they'd go home. But they can't. You know, sometimes they send a family member back because it just isn't safe enough. You know, this is such a matter of dispute, you know, but this is a very good barometer of what the real security situation is. The mixed areas in Baghdad are not, they're not becoming mixed again.
Right.
I have one driver who's a Sunni. His only real possession was his house. It was in a mixed area, but mostly Shia. He lost it 2 years ago. He was sort of, it's been taken over by a Shia family. He can't go back. I said to him, you know, maybe I know some people that we could maybe not get the house back, get some compensation, do some deal, you know. And he said, don't even mention to them. If they think I'm going to try and get my house back, they'll come and kill me. And that's the situation all over Baghdad. You know, you can't, the very few mixed areas left. And you hear this stuff, things getting better. But again, I mean, I know Sunni and Shia, now I have them working for me, and often, you know, in the same room, they'll say to me, you know, very civilized, often quite secular people, if the Sunni is in the room, Shia in the room, one or the other will say to me, don't let him know my home address, you know. And often they'll feel embarrassed. They said, look, you know, I wish I didn't feel that way, but I do. I just feel frightened if that other person knows my address. So the depth of these divisions is so deep that it'll take a very long time for them to be bridged again.
Mm. I mean, in your book, you mainly focus on Shiite Islam. You started beautifully by talking about Imam Ali. And you talked about his sons, Hassan and Hussein, and half-brother Abbas, and in the whole concept of Shiite Islam, which even actually for me it was fascinating. I grew up as a Sunni. although I hate now, ever since Iraq now, we use the term Sunni and Shiite. Nobody would ever use it before as such, really. But I was not familiar with so many things, the concept of the Hawza and Marja'iyya. And it seems to me like three families, despite the religion, there was a family dominating the feud within the Shiite community, which is Al-Khu'i, Al-Sadr, and Al-Hakim. And to a certain extent, this is the extension of everybody else who was the leader now we've seen now.
Yeah, there's a few other, as it were, members of the clerical aristocracy, not quite so senior or prominent, but let's say eight or nine families. And this is one of the many things that makes Iraqi Shiism different from Iranian Shiism. In Iran, it's much more, you know, different people become ayatollahs, become part of the clergy. In Iraq, it's monopolized by these clerical families. They've been, you know, very tough, very difficult to put out, anybody to put out of business, been around for a long time. Have very deep rivalries between the Al-Hakim and the Al-Sadr. And you know, it's one of the things, the difference between Sunni and Shia is that the Shia have, it's a bit like the medieval Catholic Church in Europe. Mm. You know, they're separate from the state. And the way the Sunni aren't, that they're sort of, the clergy are more part of the state. And also, in the background, there's a sense of dissent from the powers that be. I'm not saying that Shiism was a revolutionary ideology, but it's if you're going to dissent, then there's a feeling always that the powers that be, and always in the past, outside Iran, this was the religion of the poor, that there's always a doubt about the legitimacy of the state, of the government.
Mm. But also you're saying that the aim of the Shiites was not to destroy the state as much as to rule.
Sure,
and there is also the concept of endurance, the pain, the suffering, that you see through all these imams and martyrs, and eventually they're waiting for al-Mahdi al-Muntadhar, the return of of the Mahdi. But how does this fit in terms of politics, if you want to put religion, which is a mix between both? How would you put it in terms of a framework that ultimately, whether it's a Sadr or somebody else, that will rule Iraq in the future?
I think that, you know, I remember I knew this Said Majid al-Khu'i, who was later murdered. We could talk about who murdered him and why, which I asked.
Which
I
you
didn't,
know
I didn't quite, I didn't quite answer, but we could talk about that.
Right.
The Shia, there was a quite practical calculation on the Shia leaders' part in the 1990s, which was, they began to see, as most of the Iraqi opposition did, all this is now blamed on Ahmad Chalabi, but actually all the opposition kind of thought this at the time, which is you can't overthrow Saddam by an internal rebellion, as we'd seen that in 91. Massacre, there's a couple of chapters in the book about this great Shia uprising, which Shia remember, but nobody else does, 150,000 dead. Kurds, same thing. The only way you can do it is get somebody else to do it. The only people who can do it are the U.S., therefore you've got to cultivate the U.S., what should the Shia do? Now, there then became what since has become a cliche, which is we made a mistake under the British to rise up against them. Mm. We'll cooperate with them. And I remember talking to Said Majid about this after he'd come back from Washington in the mid-90s. Of course, there was another calculation on Muqtada's. The al-Sadrs said they'd been promoted by Saddam on their anti-Iranian, but they were also the Iraqi nationalists. It was their anti-American, anti-Iranian, and rather late in the day, Saddam discovered they were anti-Saddam as well. So that one didn't work too well. But there was a direct calculation of, you know, the Americans will invade. That's how we will get to power, and we're the majority. All we need is elections. You know, Iraq is so complicated, but there are some quite simple things about it, I think. As soon as the U.S. decided to overthrow Saddam Hussein, two things were going to happen. The Iraqi Shia were going to take power, because they're the majority. Iranian influence was going to increase, because they're also Shia, and because they had close links with the parties are going to take power, and Saddam was their big enemy. A lot of American politics involvement in Iraq has been trying to avoid this rather inevitable conclusion since, but I don't think it can be avoided.
Absolutely. And this is maybe it's a very important issue, which is the relationship with Iran.
Yeah.
At one stage, the Iranian closed Sadr's office in Tehran. Sure. Al-Hakim seems to be the Iranian guy. Walid Khoui seems to be living abroad in London. And the credibility went to Sadr because he's the one who lived there.
Sure, yeah.
And he endured all the suffering and the torture. Yeah. And he played the game with the regime, basically. Sure, yeah. But now it seems that the Iranians are funding militarily and politically and supporting Muqtada. How does this all this, what's the end game for the Iranian in terms of using the different factions?
Somebody was saying, one Shia politician was saying, you know, the Iranians can afford to compromise in Iraq. They can't afford to lose. I mean, that's their back door. So, and they don't intend to. You know, in some ways, this is, again, pretty simple. You know, it's like a corporation in Washington who wants to make sure whoever wins the presidential election or congressional elections that you've got friends there. So you put money on all the numbers, you know. I mean, this is not rocket science, either for in Washington or in Tehran. I remember one Shia politician who was actually rather anti-Iranian after a tour of around southern Iraq a couple of years ago, said to me, you know, he said, you can't really be anti-Iranian in that constituency because the Iranians are paying all the of course, they're paying all the pro-Iranian parties, and they're paying all the anti-Iranian parties as well. And it's sort of true. But also they have linked, you know, the Marjaiya, the clergy are, you know, are both in Iraq and Iran. There are lots of other pressure points. You know, Talabani, the president, where was he? You know, in the 90s, I remember when he was fighting Barzani. You know, he was supported by Iranian artillery. The idea that you can exclude Iran is, it isn't really going to happen unless you fight a war. And if you fight a war, you know, is that going to really change the political geography of the Middle East as it's been for the last 3,000 years? I doubt it, you know. But again, there are limitations. Iraqis tend to be very paranoid about Iran, not just Sunni, but Shia, and see their hand, anything that goes right to the Iranians. And maybe the Iranians encourage this, but it's sort of because it's, you know, but there are limits also to their influence, because the Iranians aren't that popular either.
Right.
But it's one of the bizarre things about Iraqi politics, you know, the present Iraqi government, the Al-Hakim family, the Supreme Council, was then called the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, was founded in 1982 in Iran by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, because they thought, that time they thought they might defeat Saddam Hussein, and they wanted kind of a puppet government to put in power. The head of the Badr organization, that paramilitary, was an Iranian colonel at that time. Suddenly these guys in Baghdad are America's best friends and turning up in Washington, you know. Yes. The Sadrists traditionally were nationalists, hated the Iranians. When Muqtada's father was killed, all the Sadrist offices had been closed down in Iran. So the Iranians tried to have a memorial service in a big mosque in Qom. And Al-Hakim, Mohammed Bakr Al-Hakim, the leader of the Supreme Council, turned up. And then all the people in the mosque started screaming, traitors, and taking off not just their shoes. I talked to somebody who was there and throwing at him. But people saw everything in their pockets, packets of cigarettes, matches, coins. So at that time, they were hand in glove. Now, has that changed? That's changed. Or how much has it changed? You know, you notice the politicians talking about denouncing the deal, the so-called security alliance that's being negotiated at the moment within the Supreme Council, and mostly from the Badr wing, they're mostly from the paramilitary wing of Skiri.
And we've seen Nur al-Maliki went to Tehran recently to explain
this
position.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is basically there is no permanent alliance in terms of vis-a-vis Iran and the Iraqi political parties. Would you see a scenario where the Iranians will sacrifice somebody like Muqtada Sadr if they think that the stability is with another party, whether it's Dawa or the council?
They might try, but you know, all these people, yes, do they get support from outside? They get money and, you know, so forth. Yeah, they do. But they never stay bought, and they never are 100% bought, you know. So, Muqtada has massive support within the country. But his relationship with the Iranians seems to be, as soon as he opposed the occupation, U.S. occupation, he needed support, he went to the Iranians. You know, the Iraqi parties always do this. The Kurds always used to do this. You know, Then there's, you know, but aha, the Iranians are supplying them, you know, with weapons, roadside bombs. But, you know, the one thing Iraq is not short of is weapons, you know, and people who know how to use them. And it, actually, the way you control militias is not big bombs, it's ammunition. Mm. That's the way they used to, the Iranians used to control the Kurdish militias, was you would keep them short of ammunition. As you may have noticed on television, if you see militiamen, they always seem to be firing their guns into the air. Well, one thing that happens if you do that enough, you run out of ammunition. So the Iranians used to control this. It's not the big guns, it's the ammunition, and it's that gives you political control. And of course, you can't fight for long without constant supplies of ammunition and so forth. And they do the same thing with the present militias. The other thing that strikes me is training the militias by Hezbollah and the Iraqis. The one thing that always strikes me about these militias in Iraq, they're incredibly badly trained.
Right.
You know, so if they are being trained, you know, somebody's really falling down on the job.
I mean, you were saying they didn't have the discipline of Hezbollah, whether in terms of obeying order or being really efficient.
Yeah, they're much bigger. I mean, how many Hezbollah fighters are there?
Well, they're talking about 40,000.
Yeah, but that's if they get all the young men from the village. You know, these militias, the same is also true of Iraq. You have hardcore who are... The Mehdi army isn't really paid. I mean, they often have government jobs. You know, there's an element of the Sadrist organization that, you know, you have to think like an American-Irish political machine 100 years ago, that the guys who are in the militia, they're not actually paid, but they have government jobs, but they never go there.
Right.
You know, so it's like your sort of ward here, you know, somebody who's your political operative. That's the way you do it. So where do they get training? They get also in the Iraqi army, because, you know, you send your guys into the army, make some money and so forth, but actually they still work for you.
Right. And actually one of the interesting things that I saw when you talked, actually there is a qualification to join the Mahdi army. Mm. You were saying that not anybody can join. They have to be a believer, they have to pray five times, and they have to be recommended by somebody. Is this the case?
They're trying to sort of, you know, discipline it. But, it was 40,000 Hezbollah, yeah, if they mobilize everybody. And that's true of Iraqi militias. You know, at a certain point, you can just get all the young men to bring out their guns, and then you can have massive numbers of ill-trained guys with guns. But, you know, it can be effective in certain circumstances. Mm. And... similarly with the Mehdi army, but it's the hardcore more limited in size. You know, the 70,000 is a figure given for the Mehdi army, but that's it's rather an invented figure. But in the villages, you know, sometimes I remember in 2004 when the U.S. was attacking Fallujah. Mm-hmm. So I just was, unfortunately for myself, caught up in the fighting. And you could see from the villages, basically all the young men were running with their guns. So that was a massive force. But it'd be wrong to call it militia. It's just everybody's armed in Iraq.
And they don't like to be called militias themselves.
Yeah, they always say they're
like
an army.
They like to be called
army,
themselves,
yeah.
We are an army.
I mean, you know, Iraq
and the
is,
word Jeshil Mahdi, obviously, it just means army.
Iraqis have always been armed. I mean, under Saddam, they were armed. It's pretty peculiar that you have this sort of dictatorship, and they all carried guns. I mean, in the early 90s, I remember talking to some Iraqi officials, they had a buyback program for heavy weapons, you know, differing from buyback programs here. It wasn't sort of pistols, it was heavy stuff. And the officials said, a tribe in the southeast Iraq had turned up with three tanks and offered to sell them back to the government. And the government, they must have picked them up during the Iran-Iraq war. And the government made an offer, and the tribal elders said, not enough. And they were last seen rumbling down the road to put the tanks back in their tribal arsenal.
That's interesting. If we talk about Sadrism again, because it's really fascinating, and again, I can't tell you enough that you should read this book, but you talked about Sadr, the martyr, the second, which is the father of Muqtada, and he said his success was the creation of a movement that blend or combine Iraqi nationalism with Islamic revival and with the cemented with religion.
Sure, yeah.
And he knew eventually that he's going to die. So basically he was led to his death.
Yeah.
He was confronting one of the most ruthless regimes, Saddam Hussein, and he died. And it reminds me somehow of Sayyid Qutb. And I don't know if there's a parallel or analogy here between the Muslim Brotherhood and some of these people who became more important in their death than in their being alive. And and they played into that till now as an inspiration to generations yet to come.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, traditionally, you know, as one says, you know, as people say, you know, that, you know, the blood of martyrs is the seat of the church. You know, it's, and it's true in Iraq and anywhere else, you know, and the, and it's not just, you know, the Al-Hakim, the present leader of the Supreme Council is Abdulaziz Al-Hakim. Is, there were eight brothers. Six were killed by Saddam. One was blown up by Zarqawi. He's the last one alive, and he's very ill, you know. The Al-Kui family I know pretty well, you know, Saeed Majid killed in mysterious circumstances, probably by Makada's people, but probably not on his orders. His brother was murdered by Saddam. You know, they suffered so horrendous casualties. Right. And but this is very impressive, you know, to Iraqis, and rightly impressive, that they think these guys really believe and really suffer. So, and of course, it's a faith that martyrdom, endurance against an oppressive authority is part of their faith, you know, and it's, but I mean, it's sort of peculiar. One moment, in 2004, Muqtada was denouncing President Bush as, you know, the Yazid. You know, I thought, how many people in the Green Zone know
what this is?
This is talking about Umayyad Caliph who'd been dead for 1,400 years, that was the traditional enemy of the Shia.
That was a good point, actually, so that when he called him the Yazid. Mm-hmm. Another character, although you're going to run another series about him, but Ayatollah Sistani. He seems to play a quiet role. He seems to be one of these people who say it's religion more than politics, but he still stepped forward and disciplined them when it's needed. His relationship with Muqtada was not really smooth, etc. Where does he fit in the whole picture?
Well, you know, there's always been a division with Shia between those, the al-Sadr family, the activist clergy. You must be involved in politics. You must be a political leader. You must oppose Saddam, etc. Denouncing the quietest clergy who say, no, get involved in politics, you discredit a religion, that you become immoral. And, you know, both these, I mean, you have a similar division in Christianity and other religions of how far should the religious leaders also be political leaders. Mm. You know, and it's an important and profound question. There was also a tactical difference that it's not the people like Sistani are apolitical, but they also calculate, you know, that we can't, under Saddam, they thought, we fight, we lose. The Shia clergy, the what they call the Hausa, will be destroyed. These guys are much more powerful than us. Keep quiet. Don't fight a battle you're going to lose. And but the Sadrists would say, you know, abandon us. Just when we were in the torture chambers, you were doing nothing, sitting in your houses. Deep bitterness because of that. But both positions are sustainable. And Sistani now. I mean, the idea, I think there is sometimes, you know, it's sort of oversold, the idea that he's apolitical. He's not. I mean, they are very political, but they don't want to get involved in day-to-day politics. But in some ways, they can't avoid it. Now, a key question over the present agreement that's being negotiated, will it be denounced by Sistani? Will there be a fatwa against it? And secondly, will he demand that there be a referendum on it, as he demanded with the constitution in 2000 and demanded it in 2003, there was a referendum in 2005. So again, these are a crucial question. People now underplay Sistani and think his influence went right down. I think it's still very pervasive. And the Supreme Council want to have his picture on all their election posters, try and give the impression that he supports them, which may well be true.
Mm. And do you think he's very old and frail and not in a good health. His departure from the scene, will it benefit certain groups as opposed to the others, or how?
Well, there'll be a fight, because the Al-Hakim want to basically take that over, you know. And there'll be a fight on who takes over.
Mainly Hakim Ansader?
Yeah, and the others too. It's but I mean, Ansader isn't. Muqtada is one of the few people, there are two Iraqis who are always called that by their first name. I know they're not in the New York Times, but among Iraqis, you know, he's called Muqtada. Mm. Saddam was called Saddam, not Mr. Hussein. But all the other Iraqis, you know, they don't call Malik al-Maliki, don't call him Nuri, they don't call he's going to, he'll remain enormously influential. Now, it's a great mistake to try and marginalize these people, to marginalize any group in Iraqi politics. You know, remember 2005, it was said that we'll have the elections, we'll have the constitution, and then somehow that will settle things. But actually, it made things much worse. I'm not saying it's not wrong to have an election or a referendum, but if a large part of the population do not accept the rules of the game, then they don't feel bound by the result of elections. In this case, it was the whole Sunni community. So actually, it exacerbated things rather than making things worse. Now we have an agreement being negotiated in Baghdad, which a very large chunk of Iraqis don't believe in. So we have an agreement, be signed, but it will have a negative effect because a lot of people just won't accept that it has any legitimacy.
Right. Talking about what happened during Saddam in terms of the atrocities against the Shias, which is many people in the Arab Sunni Arab world seems to be either ignorant about or didn't want to know about, sure. Which is most likely the second. But as much as we talked about Iran, there is also fear. You called it could be paranoia more than just legitimate fear of what King Abdullah of Jordan talked about, this Shiite axis or crescent. And they fear the dominance or the emergence of a Shiite power in Iraq. I mean, isn't it another factor to undermine the future of Iraq that ultimately, because there is so many neighboring countries involved, whether the Iranian or others, supporting not necessarily al-Qaeda, but also the Sunni politicians who are there, that we're not going to see stability for a while?
Yeah, I mean, there are limits to the power of the Shia, because, Hezbollah in Lebanon, they're really well organized, they've got power, but their power doesn't extend outside the Shia community. They can exercise it, but basically that's where their support is. Mm-hmm. I mean, the largest community in Lebanon, and similarly in Iraq, that you can be very powerful within your community, you can't extend it. So, all this talk about a Shia axis, is it going to sweep into Jordan? Well, of course it isn't, because there aren't too many Shia around there,
right.
In Saudi Arabia, yes, there is a Shia minority, it's in the oil fields, but it's a minority. It's, 10% or something. Bahrain, they're Shia, but it'll be where they're Shia. That is important, but it's limited by that. It isn't going to be beyond it. So the idea there's going to be a great sort of wave of Shia revolution sweeping through the Middle East is never going to happen because they're Sunni. This was always against common sense, to my mind, and still is.
So there's no exporting the revolution as the case was in Iran, that once they take power, they're trying... I mean, what we're talking about, the minorities in the Gulf states, basically. Mm.
Yeah, well, they don't... I mean, this didn't happen in the 1980s, when Iran wanted to export revolution to Iraq from 1979 on, they didn't succeed. And not just because of Saddam shooting people, that it was never really going to happen. What did happen was for very different reasons. So the export of revolution, I think, has always been exaggerated. The Sunni states are frightened, and also, it's often very ignorant, actually, of what goes on in Iraq. You mentioned, not knowing that the Shia had been massacred, and then you talk to Iraqis of all sorts, both Shia and Sunni, and they don't realize that the Kurds were, the extent of the Kurdish massacres, extraordinary ignorance, and they all have a Kurdish friend who doesn't like Barzani and considers himself an Iraqi and so forth. It's all nonsense, but it's they're extraordinarily ignorant on this. Hopefully when the book is being translated into Arabic, people could learn a bit more about what really happened.
Absolutely. But one thing as well, you mentioned towards the end, which is Abu al-Abid from Anbar province, that they were basically saying, we're talking about this alliance, the Sheikh Alliance, the Sahwat al-Anbar, the Anbar Awakening Council, and cooperation between them and the Americans, initiative by General Petraeus. He was saying that our enemy now are Al-Qaeda, but ultimately our enemies are the Shiites.
Sure, yeah. You know, and why do we have the Awakening Councils? Partly because of the brutality, cruelty, etc. of Al-Qaeda in Anbar province, the number of people they killed, etc., forcing people into their ranks. That happened. I mean, that was an important development. But, you know, in Baghdad, it's different. The American military commanders tried to replicate what happened in Anbar elsewhere, but often it's not quite so. You know, in West Baghdad, a lot of the Awakening Council, the Al-Sahwa groups, actually are Al-Qaeda. You know, the one Al-Sahwa guy was saying to me, you know, he said, no officer, Al-Sahwa officer, walks home without having a relationship with Al-Qaeda because it's in Saudi areas, because it's too dangerous. So the idea they've all fled to Mosul or something has never been, never really been true. It's sort of, sorry, I've now forgotten the question that you asked originally.
Well, basically that ultimately they will fight the Shiites, that their aim now...
Sure, yeah.
There's an immediate enemy, but there's a long-term enemy.
Sure, I mean, one of the other reason why Al-Sahwa developed was that the fighting in 2006, 2007 in Baghdad, in central Iraq, was essentially a very bloody civil war. As bloody as anything we've seen in many civil wars, and the Sunni lost. So eventually, you know, the idea that they would then go on fighting the Americans when the real threat to them was the Shia, you know, didn't make sense. And to a large extent, it still doesn't make sense. You know, who would the, if you're in West, Sunni in West Baghdad, would you prefer, you know, an American soldier to kick in your door at 3 in the morning or a Shia police commander to kick in your door? Well, you'd prefer the first every time. Of course, you mightn't survive the second. You mightn't survive the first either, but you certainly wouldn't survive the second. So, you know, so that fear of the Shia, the loss of the battle, really a loss of the Battle of Baghdad, and I think it's a long-term, it's underestimated this, but it's a long-term demographic change, particularly in Jordan. A lot of the people who fled are Sunni, Sunni business class, people associated with the government. They're not going to go back if they can help it. Often they have the educational qualifications, they can move on. But I think there have been real demographic changes in Iraq, and it's much more a Shia city than it was before. And you could see that everywhere, you know, in the where people live, but also in the universities. The universities are all dominated by Shia now. I think that's the long-term future.
Well, I have more questions. I'm wondering if any of the audience would like to ask a few questions, because being a journalist, you know, we want to ask all the questions. But I'm happy to see a different perspective, probably, and different ideas. But we'll start from here, yeah. Just make him short, please, because we're running out of time. I just realized I've been talking too much.
Nice to meet you. I'm Hanif Yazdi with the International City Managers Association. I had a question about which parties, which actors, in your view, in Iraq would benefit or think they would benefit from a U.S.-Iranian rapprochement, and which ones are against this rapprochement and would see their position as weakening as a result of it?
Well, the government would love to see a rapprochement. Because, I mean, there are two governments in the world who support the present Iraqi government, which is one is in Washington, the other is in Tehran. You know, the Sunni, the recent conference in Scandinavia, the Sunni states would set sort of lowly ambassadors. Hoshi Zebari, the foreign minister, an old friend of mine, was saying, you know, it was amazing, a conference, the U.S. side and the Iranian side would get up, denounce each other, and then make a very similar speech supporting the government of Iraq. But obviously they're not agreed on how much influence they have. Of course, the Iraqis are also kind of worried that, being extremely suspicious people, that at some point, this sounds very outrageous at the moment, that the Iranians and the Americans would reach a deal which will be not in the interests of Iraq. Whose phase of rapprochement? The government does, Maliki, because they're in a very difficult position. They are supported by the Iranians, supported by the Americans. And they think also if there's ever a war with Iran, you know, the worse the relations are, if there's ever a war, that the Iranians' pressure point is going to be Baghdad. It's not, you know, they are in, and things are going to get worse. The Kurds sort of, again, have a certain interest in that. Talibani, for instance, have been meeting senior, you know, the leader of the Al-Quds force on the border, the Sunni, not really. But overall, the Iraqi government wants this to happen and keep on trying to encourage it.
Hi, my name is Rick Marshall. I work at the U.S. Agency for International Development, AID. And I wanted to ask you, sort of looking right in the present and in the future, two parts, I guess. One, what is Muqtada doing right now? We understand he's in Iran. What is it? What's he really up to? A, and B, is he looking ahead, as many people in this country are, to perhaps very possibly a democratic administration that is going to start withdrawing troops? And is he looking to, with the current ceasefire, is he biding his time and waiting for us to go so that he can go back and take up
sure,
arms?
Sure, I think so. I mean, there's a general perception that probably the U.S. is going to withdraw one way or another. And that's what sort of Iraqi politicians generally think, and I'm sure Muqtada thinks that as well. So better to, if you're going to fight at all, fight later. Don't fight now. Maybe he doesn't want to fight at all. I don't think he's ever been happy with the idea of being a militia leader. He thinks of himself as a religious leader, you know, and secondly a political leader, but not necessarily a military one. So I think that they are waiting for that change. But I mean, other groups are too. They're all, you know, they're trying to perceive what's going to happen next year. The present attempt, as you may know, that Maliki denounced, said the negotiators are getting nowhere at the moment. On the other hand, the Iraqi negotiators all say, or don't say to me, you know, they're under intense pressure from President Bush and from Dick Cheney's office to reach an agreement by the 31st of July. I'm a bit mystified by this agreement because it's going to be so divisive. And it's certainly something that's not going to be set in steel in Iraq.
Or in Washington.
Yeah.
Our Congress is already...
But I mean, Hosha Zebari in January, I was talking to him about this, he said, you know, that we've got to settle these things about immunity, but it's not great if you settle it entirely in America's favor. And this is going to be very unpopular in Iraq. Secondly, what about immunity for contractors? But the U.S. Army is very dependent on contractors now. You know, both as support staff and as a security man. It's very difficult to divide the two, have immunity for one and not for the other. So this raises a whole host of issues that I think would be really difficult to resolve.
Okay. Go ahead,
In the event of something occurring, violence or a natural cause of death, what do you think would happen in a succession situation for the Sadrist?
If Muqtada was killed, you mean?
Or passed away, but that circumstance turns the power back.
That does very occasionally happen in Iraq, I suppose. But it's, haven't heard of many recent occasions, but it's this would be a big blow to them, because a lot of the Sadrist movement, yes, it's social of the poor, yes, it's nationalist, yet, but a lot of it is the personal charisma of Muqtada. This feeling among masses of people, the picture is on the wall, that he has semi-divine attributes, that's critical to it. I think without him, and there isn't an obvious successor, then I think that they'd probably split up. It is very important. You know, Shiism depends a bit on the whole idea is that somehow divine authority descends from through families. Without Muqtada, yeah, that could be very serious for them.
The lady in the middle. That's you.
Sure.
Can you identify yourself, please?
Sure. Kate Gould from the Friends Committee on National Legislation. A few days ago, we heard that the U.S. is now arming groups in Sadr City based on the Awakening model. So, following that, copying that model in Sadr City. And you know, we usually hear that they'll be targeting the special groups, not Sadr's militia, but the special groups outside of his control. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the current situation, about whether the U.S. is actually targeting Sadr's militia, or if it's special groups, and more about the distinction there, if there is one, and if this has if this is connected at all to the upcoming provincial elections.
Sure. I mean, it's an important question. I mean, I think this idea of setting up al-Safar groups in Sadr City is a really bad one, because they'll be considered just, you know, you can always hire guns in Iraq. I mean, hire people to, you know, to carry guns. And everybody does it, but doing it in Sadr City means that these guys are going to either end up dead or, you know, having to flee, because there isn't really the basis for it there. Similarly, they were trying to do the same thing in Mosul among the Sunni, but it's not going to be accepted by the Kurds. It's very difficult to get involved in local power structures in Iraq. You can do various things when the wind is behind you, like the tribes in Anbar really want to get rid of al-Qaeda. But if you try to do it in the face of local consensus, it won't really work, to my mind, and you'll get a lot of people killed. Although you can always hire people, you know, to work for you. Are they going after the Iranian support special groups? Well, there isn't a really sort of finite line, you know. Or are they going after the Sadrists in general? Well, the government wants to go after the Sadrists in general, and they want to do this before the election at the end of the year. I think that al-Sahwa is sort of, it worked at the beginning, but there were always limits to how far it could be extended to other parts of Iraq outside Anbar. When it comes to targeting the special groups, you end up, you know, the local perception may be that you're targeting the Mahdi army in general, or it may be that you're targeting Shia in general. It's very difficult to be precise. And this, you know, this creates a powerful local reaction.
The gentleman next to you, you have still have a question.
Eric Lever, Institute for Policy Studies. You spoke a lot about the role of the militias, their allegiance to different Iraqi politicians, as well as, you know, an allegiance or lack thereof to the U.S. groups that are, you know, supplying and giving them their payroll. How do you see them evolving, both in the context of the provincial elections and beyond, when the U.S. pulls out? You know, eventually, whenever that may be, are we going to see them playing a more prominent role in Iraqi society, sense of, you know, is a series of provincial warlords, or is there going to be a way to rein them in, either by buying them off and bringing them into a professional army, or remobilization into society?
It depends how powerful the state is at that moment, you know, and it's still, I think it's just still too early to say that. It's you know, the state looks powerful, but is it really there? You know, Saddam's state looked powerful, you know, but it kind of dissolved in 2003. The militias, I think that, you know, they can be absorbed, they can get given jobs, but, you know, there are so many, there are difficulties here, like the idea of, earlier this year, I was outside in Abu Ghraib and Fallujah. I met a guy called Abu Maruf, runs very al-Sahwa leader, has 13,000 men, powerful tribe, used to be in the 1920 revolution brigades. His brother is the police chief of Fallujah, powerful lot. They want to say, well, we want to join the security forces. What kind of jobs do you want? Well, the jobs we used to have under Saddam. So I was saying, well, you know, what was your job? Well, I was a major in the, you know, in the Mukhabarat, or one of the other organizations. The government is never going to do that, because that's why they, you know, they were fighting Saddam. So it's very difficult to integrate these militias, and al-Sahwa is basically a large Sunni militia, into the government. And these guys... So, but, you know, I think it could be done if you take time. you know, people have to be paid, but it has to be done very carefully. Yeah, it will take time to do it.
Hi, young lady.
Farah Hassan, also from the Institute for Policy Studies. Although not to the same extent as Iran, Syria is also playing a role in Iraq by sharing a porous border, absorbing refugees, and its political ties to various players, with Sadr even visiting Syria. Some will tell you Syria is playing a constructive role in Iraq, i.e. the Syrians themselves. Others, like the Bush administration and even John McCain of late, will tell you otherwise. Yeah. How would you describe Syria's role in Iraq, and what does that suggest for regional support in stabilizing Iraq?
Well, I think the Syrian role has changed. At the very beginning, they were very frightened. Militant statements coming out of Washington, you know, Baghdad today, Tehran and Damascus tomorrow. So, of course, it's common sense. What was their reaction to this? Well, right, you know, if you're coming for us, we'll go for you, you know. And we'll make sure that you don't stabilize the situation in Iraq. So they were giving, you know, support. And the main support is to give a hinterland to any insurgents coming across the border and so forth. Somewhat later, they decided, it's a funny thing, you know, as when the U.S. position gets weaker in Iraq, in some ways it gets stronger because the neighbors, people like the Syrians and the Iranians, get less frightened. Their perception was, no, the U.S. was not going to stabilize Iraq. And they never much liked al-Qaeda anyway. I mean, one of the first sort of Sunni insurgencies, first suicide bombers I ever came across was against the Syrian regime in 79-80. So they didn't much like them. They're frightened of them. On the other hand, they still want to various things in Iraq. So, but in the long term, you know, they don't want Iraq to break up. They want to have influence there. They don't want to be a platform to be used against them. So, you know, is it constructive, destructive? Well, it's a mixture of the two. But it's probably, I think that they're easier in their mind now. They don't feel quite as threatened because things they thought might happen to them in Lebanon haven't happened. It's pretty difficult to seal that border. I mean, it's, I used to be, when I was doing Iraq, I was kind of sympathetic to a lot of Iraqi tribes who seem to be on the border. I thought, you know, I used to think it's kind of tough on these guys. The border goes through their tribal land. Then I discovered, of course, that's why the tribe is there, that they set up shop on the border so that you can smuggle across the border, so you can smuggle you can control the trade routes, and if a government does bad things to you on one side of the border, you nip to the other. I mean, things like trying to tax you or something like that, and then you go to... So it's actually quite difficult to control that or the Iranian border. But, you know, overall, I think the Syrian role is as I described it.
Two final questions because we're running out of time. Go ahead.
Hello, John Grill with CSIS. I'm wondering if you would make any predictions about the upcoming local elections in Iraq, both election results and election-related violence.
Well, I was a couple of months ago that I think... Certainly, some people in U.S. military intelligence thought that the Sadrists would win about 60% in Baghdad and southern Iraq. That may have changed now. There's also a question, are these elections going to be fixed? If you control a city, you can sort of probably fix the election results one way or another. But what's dangerous is if they get fixed so bad that the Sadrists think, right, we're not going to get anything constitutionally. So we're going to have to try other means. So I don't think we can predict them at that moment. But the Supreme Council and Dawa have never been that popular. Dawa was very small. The Supreme Council was still tainted by their association with Iran. And for many Iraqi Shia still think, you know, it was the Supreme Council and Badr who were sort of manning the torture chambers when Iraqi soldiers were imprisoned during the war. And they've never quite escaped that sense that they're not truly Iraqi.
I just wanted to say, echo the compliment that was paid you earlier by saying that this really is an excellent book, and it's the best that's been written on Muqtada. My question for you is this. About 2 weeks ago, the Washington Post ran an article on Sadr saying that he's in Iran studying to become an Ayatollah. I was wondering if you could possibly comment on that. It also, the article also went on to say that he's studying under an Iraqi cleric, Ayatollah Mahmoud Hashemi Shiroudi, who also happens to be the head of the Iranian judiciary. I was wondering if during the course of your research you ever came across this relationship, and if you could also comment on that.
I'm always a bit dubious about Muqtada. Muqtada is always retreating to his religious studies. I think, you know, the world is full of politicians who at a certain moment don't want to say something, you know, don't want to do anything or say anything. So that's something of an excuse. Certainly he does want to rise in the religious hierarchy. He does want to be a mujtahid, but it's the religious credibility and charisma of his family is rather detached from that. The attitude of his followers it doesn't depend on him sort of solely rising through the religious ranks. So I think that's basically an excuse for Muqtada to explain why he remains silent, why he doesn't say anything. And he's done that in the past, done sometimes 7 or 8 months. He does nothing from him. And of course, if you have charisma, if you're there, people think that you have semi-divine attributes. Long periods of silence may add to your authority rather than diminishing it. You know, a politician here, a pure politician, difficult to do. But if people think, you know, you stand close to God, then long periods of silence, you know, are kind of impressive.
Okay, well, thank you for coming, everybody. And one last word. If you want to know why President Bush was called Yazid, then you have to read this book, okay?
Thank you so much, Patrick and Nadia, for this wonderful discussion. I think Patrick will be kind enough to sign a few books,
sure,
which are also for sale in the back there. And again, this discussion will be available on our website probably tomorrow.